The study of development and learning has entered a new era where instead of the kind of old-fashioned static models that we used to have, we now have tools for building dynamic theories, dynamic mathematical models of how development occurs and how learning occurs, taking advantage of the new work in nonlinear dynamics that's just happened in the last couple of decades. Today, that's what we're going to talk about, focusing a little bit on introducing what dynamics is, what some central concepts in nonlinear dynamics are, focusing especially on how we can build explicit models of development and learning with tools of nonlinear dynamics, a little bit about neural networks, a lot more about hierarchical growth and other patterns of growth that occur. So we're going to try to sketch out what these models are, what their properties are, and how we build them. This new approach, which I call the constructive dynamics of change, gives us a capacity that we really didn't have in psychology or education or sociology until recently, which is to build models that actually capture a lot of the important properties of our theories of how change occurs, of how development occurs. The older models that were around when I was in graduate school were static, were linear. These current tools, which depend centrally on the use of computers because they're much more complex than the old ones, these current tools are have a much better fit with what we need to be able to build good psychological developmental theory. There's a lot of work that's happened, mostly in the last decade, in the study of development and the study of social interaction, applying concepts of nonlinear dynamics to explain how change occurs. I've listed a few of the people there on the board. Most of them are actually in Europe, in the Netherlands and in Poland, but a couple of them are in America or in England as well. With this approach, we're trying to explain complex patterns of change, like the one in the graph, and a central piece of what we're trying to explain is how elements get coordinated, as in the blue balls, in order to create new kinds of complex behaviors or brain functioning. As we talked about earlier, and a few little ideas on dynamic modeling that we did, iteration is really an essential part of nonlinear dynamics. The process of learning, of development, involves building on what we are now to become what we are tomorrow. So the mathematical models all start with this iterative process as central to them. We, in our mathematical models, we then have a series of occasions or events or trials or states where the one that we're dealing with now is built on the one that we had yesterday or on the series of ones that we had in the recent past. In general, all of the models involve a whole bunch of factors connected to each other, affecting each other. Factors in the person, factors in the context, including other people. When they interact, they interact in a number of different ways, different types of connections, and those connections produce very dramatically different and complicated shapes of learning and development and change. I've put just a few different shapes on the slide to illustrate what some of the patterns are. Connection is really essential in these models. There are always a lot of separate pieces that have relations with each other, that influence each other. They can be connections among skills, which we talk about a lot in cognitive development. They can be connections among neurons, or neural network pieces, which we talk about a lot in neuroscience. They can be connections among people, which are essential for understanding social development, and as we've shown you by now, hopefully, also essential for understanding cognitive development, and their connections with yourself. You monitor your own behavior, and you change who you are, what you are, what you do, based on the kind of feedback from yourself. With all of these connections coming together in patterns, you have what's called self-organization. Self-organization is a fundamental process of dynamic systems. There are a whole bunch of things happening that are mostly local processes, and patterns emerge out of it. They don't require a plan to emerge. They just kind of happen out of the way the processes come together. Meteorology is a great example of how this happens. This is a picture of a hurricane, and nobody plans to make a hurricane, but the way the winds flow and the ocean currents work and the temperature of the ocean and the moisture coming up into the air, you end up with periodically hurricanes forming, and hurricanes are self-sustaining. They keep themselves going for a long time until they blow out by generally getting off the water and into land somewhere, where they have trouble maintaining the energy that they need to sustain themselves. Lots of processes in nature are self-organizing. Besides weather, of course, there are all the processes of life, which are all self-organizing processes. In nonlinear dynamic systems, the patterns of growth and change arise from a series of specifiable processes. We've already talked about iteration as one of them. Another way of saying that is that your experience determines what you're like now, what you're doing now, who you are now. A second process is the specific pattern of change. There could be many ways that change would happen, many ways that what I am today grows out of what I was yesterday. And in general, the form that most of the models assume is called logistic growth, which I'll explain a little bit in a minute. It's the basic form that life seems to take. When you describe how bacteria grow in a petri dish, or how cells grow in an ovum turning into a baby, or how plants grow on a field, or how rabbits grow in a forest, they have this logistic growth pattern. The third important contributor here is the connections that I mentioned, that there are a lot of pieces that are influencing each other, that are connected to each other in different ways. So through iteration, specific processes of growth or change, and connections among growers, we end up with a complicated system that develops or learns. And in all this, what Piaget called equilibration, what some other people call regulation, is key. These systems can explode or collapse if there aren't processes that kind of keep them on some kind of an even keel. So what's the logistic curve? What is logistic growth? Logistic just comes from the word log. It means it's basically a log growth. It's based on a power rather than the number itself. And when you plot it in most of its forms, most of its values for the simple logistic curve, you get S-shaped growth. It looks linear if you just look at the point of rapid increase, but in fact it's not linear, it's S-shaped. A whole lot of psychological measurement has finally come to acknowledge, just in the last decade or so, that most psychological processes involve logistic properties, and so a whole lot of, for example, test statistics that used to be based on assumptions of linear growth are now based on assumptions of logistic growth. It is the basic biological growth pattern. But interestingly, equation for growth, for simple growth, has dynamic properties. It has the equilibration characteristic, which you see in that it reaches a level and stays there pretty stably, much of the time for many values. It also has a property of turbulence, which even some of my statistical colleagues, like John Willard, who specializes in change, had kind of not realized this until he and I were working on dynamic systems and we came to the realization. Even simple logistic growth produces this dynamic outcome of turbulence when there's a very high growth rate, that so that the change approaches the limit on the system very quickly. The limit is called carrying capacity. This is spelled out in a little more detail in some of the readings for those of you that want to go into it. This is an example of how regulation processes can produce disequilibrium, not just equilibration or equilibrium. Here's an example of temporary turbulence with a pretty high growth rate, 1.7. You see the growth jumps up very quickly. You hardly even see the S unless you magnify the curve. And when it approaches the limit of 1, it overshoots, and then it's turbulent for just a few trials, and then it settles down. It equilibrates. That turbulence pattern is really common when there's very rapid change. My favorite example is adolescence, where there's rapid physical growth, sometimes 6 or 8 inches in a year, rapid change of the body shape and characteristics to the point that it really freaks out a lot of adolescents, rapid psychological, emotional, and cognitive change. All kinds of new capacities emerging, new emotions emerging, with puberty especially. Now, here's an example of the turbulence that lasts a longer time. Hopefully, our adolescents have the shorter turbulence rather than the longer turbulence. Here, this poor fellow doesn't really ever get it settled out until way past the end of this graph. So for most of the 100 trials, they're still up and down, but it's quieting. It isn't as bad. Maybe you could think of this as someone who's having manic depressive problems, but gradually it's settling down a little bit, not as serious from the mania to the depression. That's the equilibration process or regulation process as it settles down. Now, for some values, it never settles down. For the simple logistic growth curve. Hopefully in real life, mostly our turbulence or turmoil does settle down as we learn from it and figure how to cope with it. So this turbulence really does occur in real growth. People have only begun to study it from the dynamic perspective since this approach is so new. One of the nicest examples of it is a study by Ruland and Van Geert in the Netherlands, acquisition of language in Dutch children, including the growth of the use of personal pronouns. When they plot individual growth curves for specific one child at a time, generally in dynamic systems, you want to plot for one individual. You want to model one individual, and then you want to be able to model a bunch of single individuals. It doesn't do much good if you're trying to keep Boston out of trouble to say sometime next year there's going to be a hurricane. What you have to say is, you know, on August 30th, a hurricane's going to hit Boston, and then people can prepare for it. Similarly, it doesn't do much good to say, 10 children are going to commit suicide next year. You need to know which children and when so you can act upon that knowledge. And so, in general, we want to model individual children. Here's an example of Tomas, who was learning to use personal pronouns, I, you, me, they, we, so forth. You'll see at just about 2 years, he shows a phenomenal increase. There's a slight increase before that over a number of weeks. These are weekly measures of the actual language production in a particular session. And so there's a slow, very impressive increase starting at about 95 weeks or so. And then right at about 2 years, there's a sudden jump every measurement time, every week, there's a huge increase in the number of pronouns produced, getting up from about 10 to over 100 in a matter of a few weeks. But then in the sessions that follow that, there's a lot of turbulence, up and down, a huge variation from about 110 to about 50. That's a common pattern when there's rapid change. So when we have a child who's showing rapid change to a new cognitive level or to a new emotional level, we expect there to be turbulence like this in a number of areas. Language use is just one of them. One of the most exciting kinds of nonlinear dynamic systems that people have been working with in the last decade is models of neural networks. These are diagrams of neural networks from the work of Scheibel. You'll see a neural network at birth. These are actually neurons showing dendrites and synapses. On the left hand one, you don't see very many neurons or synapses or dendrites. By 3 months of age, there's been an enormous increase. and by 2 years, it's just incredible. It's just incredible number of neurons, dendrites, synapses, just very, very dense. And this is what happens with us in general. It continues to happen beyond 2 years, though an awful lot of it happens in the first 2 years, that we just become very, very densely neuronal. Our brains just become very complicated, incredible numbers of neurons, synapses, dendrites, connections between neurons. So many that some people would say the brain is the most complicated organ in the universe. I wonder if maybe the universe isn't more complicated than the brain, but other than that, it may be the most complicated one. I'm just going to say a little bit about these models. I'm hoping maybe some of you will do a project using either neural network models or growth models for your term paper. I'm just going to sketch out a little bit about the network models, and then I'm going to focus primarily on the growth models. The network models are, in a sense, a special case of the growth models. So in the neural network models, most of them are called parallel distributed processing models. Best single book on them for a developmentalist is the one by Ellman et al. Called Rethinking Innateness. It's really not mostly about innateness. It's about how neural networks learn. Does a very good job of describing that. So in a neural network, you've got a whole bunch of cells massively interconnected. In the math models, you try to model that. I've got a very simple diagram on the right that shows three kinds of cells that are connected to each other to give a little bit of a sense of the beginning of one of these neural networks. The cells are organized into layers. Generally, there has to be at least an input layer, things that come into the person or the network, an output layer, things that go out of it, some hidden layers where processing is done. The discovery of the importance of hidden layers is one of the great advances that led people to be able to build neural network models that actually act in a number of ways like people. When I was in graduate school, the neural network models that people were building were incredibly inadequate, blatantly, obviously inadequate. They didn't act like people at all. But starting about 20 years ago, people started to be able to build models that actually acted like people, and more that's been true. So they have many cells that are massively interconnected that are organized into layers, including hidden layers, which where the cells within the intermediate layers or the hidden layers influence each other directly. They don't have to just go through input and output. There are nonlinear transformations in the input from one to another. That's an important part of dynamic systems. It's not just linear. Often it's some kind of a version of logistic. There are weights that specify how one cell affects another, how strongly, and also the shape of the effect. I've already mentioned the hidden layers. There have been a number of impressive accomplishments from this work, practical accomplishments in addition to theoretical ones. The Defense Department, for example, and a number of industries are using neural networks now because there are a bunch of things that they can learn that previously we couldn't get machines to learn. One of the most impressive is the work by Tesoro with backgammon. Programmers had difficulty getting a computer to play backgammon effectively. They did much better with chess by using the remarkable memory and speed of a computer. The computers that play chess well do not do it like people for the most part. With backgammon, they had less success, and Tesoro simply took backgammon, wrote a program with a PDP network to learn the backgammon, had it play against itself a bunch of times, and actually was surprised, as he describes it, to find that it became very good rather quickly. Much better than anybody had been able to program before, where they were expressly writing a program for backgammon. Some people play backgammon very well too. These networks seem to learn a lot more like people. They seem to be able to learn things that people can learn, like how to play backgammon, like how to tell what's a bridge versus what's a dam when you look at a photograph, much more effectively than networks could 10 or 20 years ago. So this is an exciting area worth pursuing. If any of you are really interested in it, I would recommend that you go across the river to BU, to the Center for Adaptive Systems, where you have Steve Grossberg, Carpenter, Bullock, who are leaders in building of PDP networks and doing fabulous work in this area. So our main focus for today is going to be growth models, general growth models, which include some aspects of neural networks. In these growth models, there's generally a hierarchy. The neural networks we were just talking about, the mathematical models, are good at dealing with maybe two-level hierarchies, like how words get combined for simple grammar rules. But they're not very good at building multi-level hierarchies, which is what we really need to talk about for most of cognitive development. We need an advance to figure out how to get these mathematical neural networks to act like people that are going all the way from, crawling to walking to running to skipping, doing a whole lot of complicated things that build on each other over many years. The models that we're going to talk about are not models of networks, but they're models of how those hierarchies get built in skills or in certain properties of brain functioning, where they have three kinds of connections, primary connections that we're going to talk about. One is a prerequisite connection, which means that the later levels depend on the earlier ones and build on them through a kind of coordination process. Differentiation and integration. There's a competition process where one competes with another. There's a support process where one supports or helps out another. These hierarchical models turn out to produce growth patterns that are familiar to us in this class, the kind of a jump and plateau pattern that we've seen so often. These patterns are found for skill development, and they're found for certain cortical properties. They contrast with another class of growth patterns, which we'll talk about a little later today, that are not hierarchical, the most prominent of which is called predator-prey. So in the hierarchical model, there's a very strong type of connection, which is this prerequisite and coordination process, where you have a couple of pieces of components of skills or of brain functioning that get put together to form a new structure. That's a very powerful, strong connection in that the later structure can't be built without the earlier ones. It actually combines them, recombines them, in order to create itself. The other kinds of connections are weaker connections, but also very important for understanding the nature of hierarchical growth. They're primarily competition and support in various forms. And you need to think about them as kind of like a wind that's blowing. I think of the great sand dunes in Colorado, where you've got huge sand dunes near the mountains in southern Colorado that have been built because there's a wind blowing. And that wind keeps blowing a few grains of sand and a few grains of sand and a few grains of sand. And over many years, you end up with many, many grains of sand changing the landscape. In the same way, in development, when we have these iterations day after day after day for months and years, things can accumulate, things can combine, things can build, either over time, because they've happened a lot of times, or because there are a lot of them acting in the same way. You get what look like weak connections producing pretty large effects sometimes. An example of that is in the growth curve, so you get the spurts. You also commonly get a drop afterward. That drop comes from the effects of multiple skills supporting each other, according to our research with the mathematical model. So competition, what's competition? In competition, you have one grower taking away from another one, one skill taking away from another one. So for example, I'm learning arithmetic. When I spend a lot of time working on addition, trying to understand that, then I can't be spending that time working on multiplication. So the time I spend on addition prevents me from working on multiplication, so I'm building up my knowledge of addition and not my knowledge of multiplication. Or there can be another kind of competition where, I have two people that want to be my best friend, and one of them really doesn't like the other one. So then if it's hard for me to be best friends with both of them, because being best friends with one competes with being best friends with the other one. Those are examples of how competition affects change and development. Support. In support, one skill or grower contributes more to another. Here, if we take the arithmetic example again, when I understand multiplication very well, that typically helps me understand addition better, because multiplication is repeated addition. Multiplication actually supports understanding addition. Likewise, with the best friend example, if I have two best friends that really like each other, then we can all be best friends together, and building the relationship with one can support building the relationship with the other one. So support occurs routinely in cognitive, social, emotional development, just as does competition. A lot of the traditional discussions in the U.S. emphasize competition. It's actually not just the U.S., it's English language scholars in general. They emphasize competition and they don't emphasize support. It's part of the competitive ethic, in American ideology. So a lot of times you'll hear people talking about how things compete with each other and not talking about how they support each other. In order to build an adequate model of development, you really have to deal with both. I see this wonderfully with my children, in particular with the twins, Lucas and Carl, who are just now six. They really adore each other. They cry when they can't be with the other one many times. They help each other learn all kinds of things. Lucas is much better at gymnastics because Kara is a great gymnast and she teaches him. Kara is much better at understanding about bugs because Lucas loves bugs and he teaches her about bugs. But at the same time, they really compete a lot. They competed from the time they were conceived because they were both in the same womb, competing for the same space and the same blood supply. And they're always competing for mommy's time and daddy's time, for who gets the favorite marker, whatever it is. So competition and support are an essential part of their lives together. And if any of for any of you that have had siblings that were relatively close in age, you know what I'm talking about. So let's build up one of these models diagrammatically. We have two growers here, A and B. They're at the same level, like representational mappings, which emerge at 4 years of age. They're connected to each other through competition and support, with A competing or supporting B, and B competing or supporting A. At the same time, they also have feedback to themselves. The most obvious one being iteration, that what I am today is based on what I was yesterday. There can be other kinds as well. So we have two growers affecting each other. Just in this simple diagram, you see already there are four kinds of feedback here. Competition and support in two directions, and self-feedback for two growers. Depends on how you count it. You could say there's six. So then how do we build up connections across levels in hierarchical growth? Hierarchies mean that you have higher levels built on lower levels. So here we are diagramming just two levels. We have a prerequisite competition and support within a level and between levels. The prerequisite is primarily between levels. Competition and support are both within and between. So here we have level one with the two growers, like in the previous diagram, and we add to that the prerequisite coordination relationship leading to a new grower at the next level, level two. We also have competition and support between levels. So grower A is competing with and supporting grower C, and grower B at level one is competing with and supporting grower C. We have more than that, right? Because at the second level, grower C is going to have other growers that it's connecting to, other skill components. We think about these as addition and subtraction. You know, you have grower A and B are addition and subtraction. They get coordinated into an understanding of putting together and taking apart single numbers. And then you've got multiplication, too, and division. And those are also developing separately, and they need to get coordinated. So you have grower C and grower D coordinating with each other at the second level. And of course, they are going to then not only have a competition and support and self-feedback, but they're also going to build up to the following level, where again, there's a relationship of prerequisite and coordination, and a relationship of competition and a relationship of support. So when we go across levels, then this is a little bit simplified. It doesn't include all the competition and support arrows in the diagram. You see we go to three levels. We think they're eventually going to have to be at least 13 to capture the whole course of development from birth to 30 years of age, but here I've diagrammed three of them with just two growers at each level to give a sense of the way the model is built for hierarchical development. We've taken this model and tested it to see whether it fits growth curves that we actually have from real data from people developing. One of the places we tested it was on the development of concepts of self and relationships. For example, in the Korean study, which you've read about and heard about in the self and relationships interview. The question was, one of the questions, do optimal level growth and functional level growth both derive from the same growth process, or do we need different growth models for these two kinds of growth curves that we get? And the answer has turned out to be that it looks like we don't need two different models. All we need is different values for some of the growth processes, in particular different growth rates. So here's an example of The growth curves from the Korean study for self-interested relationships, optimal level at the top showing a series of spurts, functional level at the bottom showing smooth growth. You see here that we only have a few points. We would need really a lot more points to be able to carefully model precisely the dynamics of it. Here's the same curve from the model showing very similar growth curves for optimal and functional level, where the only difference was that for optimal level, the growth rate was 0.1, and for functional level, it was only 0.03. So when you have a low growth rate, the bumps tend to get smoothed out, and you have a more continuous growth. When you have a high growth rate, the bumps become more dramatic. If you have a very high growth rate, the bumps become very dramatic. You get the turbulence or the drops after the jumps. Now, really, this model is fairly simple in conception. When you look at the optimal level growth curves, it looks like a series of S-shaped curves stuck at the end of each other. So here we have one S-shaped curve, logistic curve, and here we have a second one. And to get the optimal level curves at their simplest, you just need a series of those. And basically, that's what the model is at its simplest. It's one logistic grower followed by another one that the first one was a prerequisite for, followed by another one that the second one was a prerequisite for, and so forth on up the hierarchy. Of course, because there are a lot of things connected and a lot of different forces going on, the growth curve does not always look like that. It may take many different forms. This is a dynamic, nonlinear model. But at its simplest, it's a series of logistic S-shaped curves, and my experience is it helps people to understand it, to think about it that way as a starting point. Each of the points where the S flattens out is an attractor or a point of equilibrium in dynamic terms. You'll remember this curve from before, where we were working with the same model, and you were seeing a series of jumps followed in some cases by drops showing this attractor effect, most dramatically at the end, but also along the way for each of the five levels. Now, this is a dynamic model, and I'm going to just illustrate that very dramatically with one example. I could give you 100. When the values are in a certain range, you get this nice Piagetian kind of growth. When the values are different, you can get very different effects. There's a whole series of phenomena in nonlinear dynamics which are really dramatic changes in patterns. And I'm going to show you actually two of them. This first one is the catastrophe model. Van der Maas and Molinar in the Netherlands have suggested that the changes that you see in with cognitive levels or stages with these jumps are actually catastrophes. And catastrophes are defined mathematically. It's not like the Empire State Building collapses, but it's like there's a really striking discontinuous change. In the cleanest case to explain, there's actually a jump from one level to another with nothing in between. Those catastrophes, they say, characterize the shape of cognitive development, and they use in particular the cusp catastrophe model, and they've suggested that it might explain the optimal and functional level effects. I've diagrammed that here to show you. Those huge bumps at the top are what are called cusp catastrophes in catastrophe theory. They have certain mathematical properties. But on that space, you see, at the bottom of this saddle, as they call it, there aren't any jumps. So with the same catastrophe model, very well defined mathematically, you get catastrophes for some values and continuous growth for others. It looks a lot like what we're talking about with optimal and functional level. But there's also other kinds of catastrophes which are really, in a sense, more dramatic in that we're not used to them. When we look at cognitive development, where we expect things to be relatively orderly, they're broadly called butterfly effects, where a very small change in one variable produces a huge change elsewhere. These are the kinds of effects that have led to a whole lot of changes in science in the last 10 years, if you've been following. For example, just 10 years ago, a lot of people would say that we could predict the orbit of the Earth 10,000 years from now with great precision. Now people know that's not true, because the Earth's orbit is a nonlinear dynamic system. And it turns out, when you build a model of that, that for certain values, just a small change, so small that it's within the error of measurement, can produce a really dramatic change in the orbit. Sometimes. Not usually, but sometimes. It's called a butterfly effect because one of the most dramatic early descriptions of it was for weather. And the description was that you could have a weather pattern going on nice and smoothly, so the weather in the Caribbean was beautiful in the summer. And then a butterfly in southern Italy flaps its wings, creates a slight difference in the wind currents, not even measurable by meteorological instruments, and that produces a hurricane in the Caribbean a few days later. So those kinds of effects happen a lot, and we discovered some of those effects for this model to our surprise. When we were putting the model together, really we hadn't even thought about this issue, and we were playing around with it, and lo and behold, some of these effects sort of jumped out. That's why I call it computer games for professors, because it's when you're working with these things, you find it's very compelling to play with the values of the growth processes to see what happens, because a lot of surprises jump out. Here we have the attractor effect that you've already seen. Now, if we take exactly the same model, and the only difference we do is that we boost growth early on for the blue grower just once, we get this instead. So we put a boost there at early on in the growth process, one-time boost. It produces a very different pattern. Now, instead of stage-like growth, we have we still have the ups and downs, but they're not moving towards an attractor level that's common across the growers. Instead, you've got a spread of the domains, with the one that you gave the boost to ending up with the lowest level, and the ones you didn't boost ending up with the higher level. Even though early on when you gave the boost, that one got higher, but it didn't stay higher. This is we named this for Piaget on his 100th birthday, because this is a phenomenon he talked about a lot, saying that you Americans, you always want to boost early development, and you shouldn't do it, because you got to be sure that what you're doing fits naturally with the child, with what's natural for the child. If you teach children things that aren't appropriate for them at an early age, you're going to mess them up. So this model turned out to produce an effect like that. So we named it for Piaget. Now, Paul van Geert, one of the Dutch researchers that I've mentioned several times, who's done some of the best work in this area, published a couple years ago a mathematical model where he took Piaget's ideas about equilibration, and he built a model from them. He also then added on a few ideas from Vygotsky and looked at the model again. And what he found was a great shock to him. In the case of the logistic hierarchy I just showed you, it's not so surprising that there's a series of spurts, because we have a series of logistic curves that are prerequisites for each other. In this model, nothing like that was built in at all. Just the kind of equilibration processes that Piaget talked about. There's assimilation and accommodation, kind of seeking balance with each other. There's a slow long-term acquisition rate. There's a kind of relationship between the child and the environment, where the environment can be closely matched or not so closely matched to what the child is understanding or doing. The surprise was that when the child and environment are not closely matching each other, so the environment is not trying to track the child and teach the child at every moment the way a behaviorist might, then you end up with stage-like changes that emerge. And not only did they emerge, but there were usually four of them, which is the number that Piaget hypothesized. So we were all flabbergasted. We still don't really understand exactly why. More work needs to be done with the model to see why it produces that. You know, it's not very interesting if you get four growth levels because you built them in. But if you just start a system and let it going in, it spontaneously creates four levels, or if it spontaneously creates levels at all, that's interesting. So this is what happened for some of the values. For some of the values, this didn't happen. For some of the values, other things happened. This is one of the properties of dynamic systems. They show very different growth properties depending upon the values. But for a whole bunch of the values, they produce something like this. With four levels of cognitive development, or four stages. Interestingly, for some of the values where it wasn't so temporally ordered, there was a lot more jumping up and down, still there were four levels. So there's something very basic about the model that's producing four levels most of the time, occasionally three, occasionally five, modally four. Okay, now there's non-hierarchical growth too. And I wanted to give a good example of that so we have an idea of the range of processes that are going on. In non-hierarchical growth, you have things affecting each other, but they're not building on each other. Or they're only building on each other in very limited ways. The ones that are usually described come from ecology and evolution, where there was a whole lot of model building starting 20 years ago, Maynard Smith in England and others. Trying to understand how it is that species change over time. One of the phenomena they wanted to explain was why there are huge increases and drops in populations. So some of you remember a few years ago there was a gigantic surge in the certain kinds of moths here in New England eating trees. That kind of phenomena happens all the time in the predator-prey kinds of situations. So people built models of this predator and prey species, and they discovered, lo and behold, based on the very simple properties of predator and prey, that's the kind of growth cycle you're going to get. It just comes out of the system. So if you have cats eating mice, or if you have cows eating grass, over time you're going to have times when the mouse population explodes and times when it crashes. You're going to have times when the grass population explodes and when the grass population crashes. And of course, the cat and the cow have to follow the mouse and the grass to some degree, right? So here's how it works. You've got natural oscillations in predator-prey populations. Here we have a cat and a mouse looking like maybe they're friendly, or is that cat going to eat the mouse? Anyway, the mouse population is growing. Turns out there's some cats in the neighborhood. Well, they eat the mice, and so gradually the cat population grows. Then there are so many cats, they start eating most of the mice, the mouse population drops. Okay? So then, of course, the cat population has to drop over time. And then again, the mouse population increases, and a little bit later the cat population increases, and this is the way it goes with predator and prey. So the things that prey on the gypsy moths grow as the gypsy moth population is growing until they outgrow the gypsy moth population, in a sense, wipe it out, and then the gypsy moth population crashes. And then the predator population crashes. When the predator population crashes, then the gypsy moth population can jump up again. And so we get times when the gypsy moth population takes off, and then the predator population grows, and it eats up the gypsy moths, and they drop off again. So this happens with all kinds of parasites and all kinds of predator-prey relationships. It's I lived in Colorado where it happened with pine beetles. Every so many years there'd be a huge surge of pine beetles which carry a fungus that kills the pine trees. And if you had 20 pines in your yard, you didn't want all your pines to be dead, so people were very concerned about it. This predator-prey model explains that. Well, it turns out that predator-prey models describe certain kinds of properties of the cortex. In particular, where it's best documented at this point is patterns of coherence in the EEG. We've talked about these a little bit before. Coherence is the correlation between waveforms in different parts of the cortex. And when you look at how that changes over time with age, you see an oscillation pattern, an up and down pattern. Before, we emphasized that there was a phase transition at certain points in that process, points that correlated with when we see major cognitive levels emerging. But notice the property of oscillation. That's a predator-prey property. If you think about predator and prey in this case, most of these curves showing this oscillation pattern involve the frontal cortex connected with someplace else. In a sense, the frontal cortex is acting like the rabbits feeding on the clover, with the clover being the back of the brain, the frontal cortex being the rabbits. And so the rabbits limit the amount of clover and their growth depends on the amount of clover. Likewise, the frontal cortex, in some way we don't understand yet, limits or controls the growth of waves in the back of the brain or in the middle of the brain and in the middle of the brain, but also feeds on them. So it doesn't mean it literally eats the brain, but in some sense it depends on them for its growth. Here's another example from another frontal parietal connection from the same study, where you see, again, the phase transition in coherence right there at about the same age. A whole lot of them show changes at about 7 years of age. You also notice, again, that there are oscillations. Here I diagrammed it to make it really clear. You see how the oscillation period changes. It's longer and then it becomes shorter. Also, of course, the oscillations are wider and they become narrower. Generally, these oscillations shifts, the changes in the oscillations, which Thatcher calls cusp catastrophes, occur in his study at about 3 to 4 years, 5 to 7 years, 9 to 10 years. We suspect that there would be other ones at about 15 years and at about 2 years, but the data aren't really there at this point to test that. One more example. This is within frontal, on the right side, one frontal area feeding on another. You also are getting an oscillation pattern, though it's a little less systematic, a little more complicated. Again, with a shift at about 7 years of age. These are growth patterns for coherence, which involve pairs of cortical areas, the connections between waves patterns in pairs of cortical areas. And they show this predator-prey model, which is very much like the ones from ecology and evolution. It turns out they also show other kinds of growth models Thatcher has shown, including competition, cooperation or support, and independence, where there's basically no connection between them. Predator-prey is the most prominent, but the other patterns also occur, and they vary systematically depending upon where they are in the brain. We don't know quite what to make of this yet. This is a brand new finding. If any of you have any ideas, it's definitely worth pursuing. Here we have the general distribution in Thatcher's data. In the left hemisphere, you have a predominance of predator-prey patterns. You only have a few cooperative and independent patterns, no competitive ones. In the right hemisphere, it's very different. Still, predator-prey is predominant, but it makes up less than half of the overall patterns. About half. And you've got a lot of competitive ones, a lot of cooperative ones, and independent ones. It also depends on the cortical lobe. So here we show predator-prey connections for the two hemispheres. You'll see 84% of the connections in the left hemisphere are predator-prey, and most of those are frontal to posterior. Frontal to parietal, frontal to occipital, frontal to temporal. In the right hemisphere, they're also mostly frontal to middle or back, but they're only 48% of them. Now, if we look at the competitive connections, they're all in the right hemisphere, none that he found in the left hemisphere, and they're virtually all frontal-frontal or frontal-temporal. So they're towards the front of the brain in the right hemisphere. In the cooperative connections, where one is supporting another one, we call them supportive, he calls them cooperative, you have central to parietal or temporal, the middle of the brain. So the frontal isn't involved in the cooperative one. See, the frontal is the predator. frontal is, so the other, the kind of middle, toward towards the back, though not all the way to the back, in both hemispheres, but twice as many in the right as in the left. And then finally, for the independent connections, you have about equal numbers in the two hemispheres, and they mostly involve, again, the middle part of the cortex. So virtually everything from front to way back is predator-prey. And virtually everything in the left hemisphere is predator-prey. But in the right hemisphere, it's much more complicated and interesting, especially in the middle. So you see, this is I think I said this is new. We've never known anything about this before. It's an example of how dynamic systems analysis can begin to tell us something about brain functioning. Now we have to figure out what it's telling us. So overall, I've tried to give you an idea of what dynamic systems are, in particular how they apply to analyses of growth, development, learning, based on the new science of nonlinear dynamics, or as some people would say, structure on the edge of chaos. One of the interesting things about nonlinear dynamics that's come out in the mathematics of it is that chaos is a very specific mathematically defined state, and most of the interesting structures are right on the edge of chaos mathematically. If you get far away from chaos, the structures aren't very interesting. If you're in the middle of chaos, it's very disorderly in a systematic way. But right on the edge of chaos, you get interesting structures like life and solar systems. So that's what we're trying to understand in doing nonlinear dynamics of growth and development, that structure on the edge of chaos. We've talked about neural network models a little bit, what some of their properties are, the growth of skills, the growth of cortical activity in networks, and how they fit several kinds of nonlinear dynamic growth models. In particular, we've focused a lot on hierarchical growth, which captures a lot of characteristics of skill development, as well as some characteristics of neural network connection development. Dealing with concepts like turbulence and attractors and equilibration and catastrophe and butterfly effects. And we've also talked about another class of models that don't show hierarchical growth, but that do involve growth in a funny sense. Sometimes people used to say that development had to be progressive, things had to be getting consistently better or improving or going upward somehow. Now we wouldn't say that anymore, because we know we can build a very systematic developmental or growth process that produces changes that are systematic but don't involve progress, like in a predator-prey relationship between two species.